You can't get much more explicit than an existential threat to the security of the nation. What 5G does is to exacerbate all of the challenges that we have seen heretofore in cybersecurity because of the fact that it is an all software network, because of the fact that there are no centralized choke points, because of the fact that you've got tens of billions of devices for which cyber is not a priority attaching to them, and because of the fact that you've got all these new applications using the devices and the network, and the applications aren't built with cyber as a forethought either.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 3rd, 2019. 5G telecommunications networks are beginning to be rolled out in the United States and around the world. We've heard a lot about the national security concerns posed by Chinese companies like Huawei getting a foothold in 5G networks. We're told it is important to win the race to 5G, that China is aggressively deploying 5G technology, and that the United States and the West are lagging behind. But is this the right way to think about the security challenges posed by 5G? What would it really take to deploy 5G in ways that adequately address the cybersecurity concerns posed by this new technology? I sat down with former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission and Brookings scholar, Tom Wheeler, to discuss these issues and his new article on why 5G requires new approaches to cybersecurity. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 449, Tom Wheeler on the need for real cybersecurity for 5G. So, Tom, I'm not sure the Lawfare Podcast has done an episode exclusively dedicated to 5G. And I know our listeners will be pretty savvy about the national security issues that have been talked about in the press, like Huawei and other Chinese companies' involvement in this space, which we'll get to. But I think I'd like to start with the basics. I think most people, when you think of 5G, you think of something that will make streaming movies on your phone easier and faster. But as you are well aware, it's much more than that. It has infrastructure and applications components. So start us out. What is 5G exactly? Why is it such a big deal? And how is it different from 4G?
Well, 5G is a reconceptualization of what a communications network looks like. Heretofore, networks have been hub and spoke, if you will. And you have the image of the switchboard operator. You know, they were sitting there all lined up and they were plugging wires in to make connections. And that got electrified over the years and automated. But it's been pretty much the same since those early days. 5G changes that because 5G is, for the most part, an all software network that, rather than having those kind of centralized points where activity happens, uses digital routers that are distributed throughout the network to move the activity out into decentralized places. And so the challenge that that creates for cybersecurity is, first of all, software is per se hackable. And secondly, the choke point that used to be represented by those hubs that all the lines came into, where you could conduct cyber hygiene, is gone. And so we have a network that is an all software network, an all distributed network that creates an entirely new set of challenges insofar as cybersecurity is concerned. So you have a new network structure that creates brand new vulnerabilities by its design. And the question is, are we stepping up and also bringing new cyber protections, or are we still doing it the same old way?
So before we get to that, which is the nub, I think, of the question here, can you just talk a little bit about what are the types of applications for 5G that are garnering the most attention? In other words, why do people care about this? If I'm using my 4G phone, soon it'll, you know, it even says 5GE right now. Right. Like, why is it going to matter to me?
That's a great question, Margaret. And at the outset, what you're going to see is that you'll be able to download movies faster and things like this. But that's not the future of 5G. The future of 5G is that this all-software distributed network is going to allow brand new kinds of functions. So let's just and that's because of two things. One, the speed of the network. And secondly, the latency. So what's latency? Latency is the time you have to wait between making a request and getting an action. When it's, I want to see House of Cards, you don't care if you got multiple seconds of latency. But if you're trying to use this for remote surgery, you really care. You need to have instantaneous, no latency. You know, when I was at the FCC, we did a demonstration in which I sat at the offices of the FCC and operated a piece of heavy construction machinery, one of those diggers, that was in Dallas. And the point was to demonstrate that I had instantaneous control. And so this ability to have very low latency opens up all kinds of new horizons, of which, for instance, remote surgery is a real example. The second issue is the speed. Yes, you'll be able to download movies in seconds rather than minutes, but it will also be possible to move great amounts of data back and forth between computing devices. And perhaps as importantly, you've heard of the Internet of Things. Really what that is small computers in everything from baby monitors to traffic signal controllers that are communicating with the Internet. But they are doing it with very small bits of data. But when you send data from a projected 50 billion connected devices, that's with a B, 50 billion, you can choke a network real fast. And so you need the kind of bandwidth and the kind of throughput speeds that 5G is going to offer. So 5G, in a nutshell, is two things: greater throughput speeds and very low latency that open up all kinds of new services and new capabilities.
Great. So let's move to, I think, what our listeners on Lawfare will already know a fair amount, because I think we've talked about it before. There's been a lot in the press about Huawei, which is the largest telecommunications company in the world, and the threat that is posed by that company and others. So can you just walk us through that whole set of issues and sort of what the latest is and what's going on with Huawei?
Well, so the Trump administration's efforts with regard to keeping Huawei out of domestic telecommunications network is actually a continuation of what happened in the Obama administration when they were trying to disabuse the major carriers of using Huawei equipment. And I think it makes sense.
It is an additional step that was taken, I think, right by the Trump administration with putting Huawei and the related companies on the export list.
On the list, the question became whether we were engaged in cybersecurity or trade negotiations. But be that as it may, the cyber issues with Huawei are real issues. Do you want to have the software running your network built by an adversary who knows where the back doors, for instance, are? I think discretion is a better part of valor here. And that's why they, as I say, the Obama administration urged the companies, the network companies, not to use Huawei. And this is a logical extension of that.
And my understanding is that there were certain exceptions that were put in place when Huawei and related entities were put on the export list that, as of, you know, right now, continues to allow, for example, small rural networks to continue to be supported by Huawei and continue to sort of purchase those products. Is that correct?
Well, it's an ever-changing issue. As of today, when we're taping this, there was some more freedom that was given and another 90-day time extension. But I think there's a broad question here. There are about 40 different rural wireless carriers, companies, that did not follow the admonition saying, don't do this, and went ahead and did use Huawei. And if it is important that Huawei not be in American networks, which I believe it is important that they not be in all American networks. Because if you have, you know, East Overshoe Telephone Company connecting to Verizon, that is a vulnerability that you want to preclude. And so these companies are going to have to take out the equipment. There's legislation in Congress to fund their replacement of the Huawei equipment. It is disappointing they used the Huawei equipment in the first place.
I also saw that there was legislation introduced in late July that I think was acknowledging some of the concerns that members of Congress had about whether the Trump administration is using Huawei as a bargaining chip in the trade space. It's essentially legislation that codifies the ban on Huawei and then, you know, only authorizes changes to the ban if Congress approves it. So I do think Congress is sort of watching this space and is interested and concerned about the Trump administration and President Trump himself using it as a bargaining chip on the tariffs and
trade.
But
you know, Margaret, one of the problems here is that the Huawei is a legitimate issue, but it has sucked all the oxygen out of the discussion of 5G cyber. And cybersecurity for 5G networks is so much more than the issue of Huawei. And so what I try to point out in the paper, what David Simpson and I try to point out in the paper, is the breadth of the issues that are created when you have a software network that is distributed across where the activity is distributed across the network, those vulnerabilities, and then you have new devices hooking into it, and then you have new applications on top of it, and you're talking about the creation of the most important network of the 21st century with billions of cyber attack vectors. You know, our networks have always been how attacks were delivered, right? I mean, I don't care whether it was the railroad network or the road network or the, you know, why did Britannia rule the waves? To protect their networks to the empire, right? And so we're surprised that our new network is an attack vector. We shouldn't be, number one. And number two, we should be defining programs to preclude those attacks or protect against those attacks in terms of the nature of the new network, not in terms of the nature of the old network. And that's the challenge that really nobody has focused on insofar as 5G and that we try and deal with in our paper.
Yeah, I'm glad you moved to your paper because I think it's really important. I read it. It's been published by Brookings. I thought it was terrifying when I read it. So I encourage everyone to find it and read it. I think it will change the way people focus on national security issues think about 5G and what is important going forward. So thank you for writing it. There's one particular quote in there that was particularly terrifying to me. So I want to ask you more about it. You say that the President's National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee, which is composed of leaders of the telecommunications industry, advised the President in November that, quote, the cybersecurity threat now poses an existential threat to the future of the nation, unquote. And you talk about how 5G is going to exacerbate those threats. So can you tell us a little bit more about that quote and what those folks had in mind?
You can't get much more explicit than an existential threat to the security of the nation. And the interesting thing is that that threat is coming from the people who run our networks, the people who are building the new 5G networks. And to use the kind of word existential threat, as they did, clearly was designed to convey a degree of seriousness. And what 5G does is to exacerbate all of the challenges that we have seen heretofore in cybersecurity because of the fact that it is an all software network, because of the fact that there are no centralized choke points, because of the fact that you've got tens of billions of devices for which cyber is not a priority attaching to them, and because of the fact that you've got all these new applications using the devices and the network, and the applications aren't built with cyber as a forethought either. And so we need to change the paradigm to one where we are not just reacting to what people are doing on the networks, but we're anticipating them. And if we are not proactive in anticipating the challenges that will face us on the 5G network, shame on us.
One of the things I really like about your paper is that it doesn't just point out what the threats are. It actually goes into, in some pretty concrete detail, steps that can be taken going forward to secure the network. You know, can you talk a little bit about some of those more specific ideas that you have and kind of how it would work? And also, you know, in reading your paper, it occurred to me that, you know, our existing governmental structures, so for example, the FCC, is not designed as a national security agency. So do our governmental structures need to change or be, you know, improved somehow? And if so, how to really approach this question as a national security issue?
Well, the next time you have an hour and a half for a podcast, we could talk about all of those issues because you certainly opened a lot of boxes there. But in general, we have heretofore had a policy that says, well, you know, deregulation is what is really important. You know, for instance, when I was chairman of the FCC, we put in place a requirement that 5G, the 5G standard, had to proactively deal with cybersecurity issues. And then we opened what in administrative terms is called a notice of inquiry, in which we said to the smartest minds in America, tell us specifically how we do this proactively. I think we asked 132 questions. It was opposed by the Republican commissioners at the time. And when the Trump FCC came in, under the guise of deregulation, they killed that effort. And they went so far as to say that the FCC has no authority over cybersecurity, which I find incomprehensible. Section 1 of the Communications Act says that it's the responsibility of the FCC to provide for national security and public safety. And if that isn't cybersecurity, then I don't know what is. But the fact that under the Trump FCC, the decision has been taken that the agency responsible for the nation's networks will not be dealing with cyber issues is to me incomprehensible. But that then goes to a broader question. You asked, are our structures of government adequate to the task. And you know, government as we know it today was built around management concepts that were developed in the industrial age. When government started overseeing the marketplace, it took the behavior of the companies in the marketplace insofar as rules-based bureaucracies and made it their own. The problem is there are no companies anymore that are that rules-based and bureaucratic. The name of the game in management today is called agile management. Yet we have yet to begin to deal with agile regulatory approaches. And so one of the things that we suggest in the paper is there needs to be a new approach to how we think about governmental oversight. That yes, we'll stipulate that government is slow, often sclerotic, and that keeping up with the changes in technology is difficult. But that doesn't mean that you don't deal with the issues that get raised. It just says that you need to bring a new way of thinking to deal with these new challenges. And just like we imported concepts from the industrial age, we need to start importing management concepts from the internet age. For instance, it used to be that software was produced just like Henry Ford produced Model Ts. It moved down the production line, a guy added a bumper, somebody else added a light, and at the end, boom, you had a car that rolled off at the end of the production line. Software was done the same way. Software doesn't work that way anymore. Software today is never finished. You know, when you go home and your smartphone says, we're going to download new software to you tonight, that is an example of agile software management, constantly changing to constantly reflect the new realities that exist. We need to think about how does government operate that way, and that's going to require a new non-adversarial relationship between the companies that are regulated and the regulators. And we suggest in the paper that it needs to be built around a concept, an old common law concept called the duty of care, that somebody who is producing something has a responsibility to anticipate the ill effects of what they're doing and to mitigate those effects. And that ought to apply in cyber as much as it applies traditionally. And so we need government and the companies to agree on what is the level of cyber duty of care, and then to manage to it and for government to create incentives. Regulation should be less of the punitive after the fact, aha, we caught you, and more of the we want to provide you with incentives. Financial incentives, legal incentives, other incentives to step up and exercise this duty of care. And if you exercise this duty of care, your government will respond accordingly to support you. That is a sea change in how we think about government. We have to make government proactive rather than reactive. Because there's one thing we know for sure. Technology is changing faster than any of us could create structures to deal with. And the bad guys, whether they be nation states or those working for nation states or criminals who want to take advantage of the cyber vulnerabilities of 5G, are working fast themselves. And so we have to be equally as agile. And that means we need to rethink the structures of government.
So I hear what you're saying. And what you're saying sounds very expensive to me. So I want to kind of talk about, you know, I think the other kind of conventional way that we think about 5G and national security is sort of like a great power competition between China and the United States, or China and the West, or China and the US and its allies. And that whole discussion has been around sort of the race to deployment. And I know you're critical of that sort of rhetorical structuring of the race to 5G. But isn't there something to it? I mean, my understanding is that if, for example, China is able to get a critical mass of its citizens connected into 5G, that creates the economic incentive for, you know, new products and new services to be created around 5G, which then allows, you know, whoever innovates those products and services to export to other markets. And that is an economic advantage. What you're talking about seems to me to be imposing a layer of safety and security, which is great, but also a layer of cost and deployment delay that China doesn't have, or they just don't seem concerned with it. So how do we deal with that piece of it in the context of your very responsible and, I think, and smart suggestions?
Well, you know, Margaret, we weren't the first to build out 1G or 2G or 3G or 4G wireless networks. Yet it is United States companies, American companies, that dominate the provision of key technologies and services in the wireless space. So I think this is less of a race with a finish line and more of an ongoing effort to take advantage of the new technologies and deploy it. We're deploying 5G in this country right now on an evolutionary basis by taking the existing spectrum and, if you will, strapping pieces together to create this high-speed, low-latency network. China has decided they want to do it as a forklift. Just come in, rip everything else out, and do this. You can do that in a managed economy, you know? But an economy where the companies need to demonstrate a return on their investment, you ease into things more. But that doesn't mean that we're losing either the incentive or the ability of our companies to build the applications, to build the software that is necessary to construct the networks, to build the chips that are essential for 5G. All areas that we dominate today, and I think we'll continue to dominate.
So another of the sort of foreign policy, national security issues that surrounds us, this question of China's dominance through Huawei and other similar companies, is they're actually going out and selling complete systems to, you know, African countries, or, you know, even our allies. I think Iceland and perhaps even Turkey are potential customers of Huawei. And so what about that? I mean, we American companies aren't the ones going to these countries and to our allies and selling the system. It is China coming in and selling them those systems. Are we too late on that? Should we just focus sort of on what's going on here and make sure it's secure? What do we do about that piece of it that is also an economic competition and national security piece?
Well, ever since Motorola and Lucent shut down, we do not have any infrastructure companies in this country. And one of the things that we haven't done that you would imagine would make sense would be to say, okay, what are we going to do to make sure that Western-oriented companies, Nokia, Ericsson, Samsung, etc., are given advantages that enable them to compete with the subsidization, the low-cost loans, the way in which the Chinese government makes it possible for Huawei to almost give away their infrastructure, and that we ought to be thinking in terms of what are we going to do to support a Western alternative, and what are the policy issues of that going to be?
One of the suggestions I heard from a colleague on up on Capitol Hill, someone I was talking to, was that, you know, the United States should partner with, for example, Europe and South Korea potentially, and, you know, several of these other countries that are sort of far along but not as far along as China, and sort of all get together and use the economies of scale to be more of a competitor to these pretty well-established Chinese companies. What do you think of that idea? Do you think it's viable? Do you think it's something that, for example, the Trump administration should pursue as a diplomatic, sort of public-private diplomatic initiative? Or is that just sort of pie in the sky?
Well, this is something the Europeans have already demonstrated they're good at. The 2G technology and the 3G technology were technologies where the European government said, we're only going to use this specific GSM standard.
What is a GSM standard?
Global System Mobile, which was the 2G and 3G standard. And European countries said, it's been developed by European companies. This is all we will use here. We didn't take that approach here. We had multiple conflicting standards. But it's clear that it has worked in the past. And I think I was suggesting something not dissimilar to that. I mean, how do Western nations work together to favor Western countries? The difficulty is that, at least with the current administration, we seem to have a hard time doing things collectively.
That is true. I cannot argue with that. Thank you so much, Tom, for coming in and talking with me. I really appreciate it.
Margaret, thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks to Tom Wheeler for coming on the show this week. Please share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Jacob Schultz was our audio engineer this week, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.